Breakfast and lunch is being served to children until July 14th at Dana Gray Elementary School in Fort Bragg. Space's Performing Arts Summer Camp starts June 29th at the Space Theater in Ukiah. Grid Alternatives, a nonprofit solar organization promoting access to renewable energy and job training in underserved communities, is offering a community informational meeting on Thursday, 7 p.m. at the Philo Grange. The San Francisco Mime Troupe opens its 2015 season on Wednesday at 8 p.m. at Arena Theater in Point Arena with the premiere of Freedom Land. They'll also perform on Thursday, 7 p.m. in Todd Grove Park, Ukiah, with a half-hour live music set before all show times, open to all. Willett's Hometown Celebration is Thursday from 5 to 9 p.m. with live music, entertainment, and kids' activities. And Native American Spirit Runners culminate their 500-mile relay marathon on Friday with a rally at Willett City Park, 1:30 p.m., to celebrate the spiritual tradition of Native messenger runners. Please submit your public service announcement at least 2 weeks in advance and check out our complete events calendar at kzyx.org.
At just about 1 minute after 7 o'clock, you are tuned to KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits and Ukiah, K201 HR 88.1 FM Fort Bragg. We're Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, listener-supported community radio. We stream live on the web at kzyx.org. Support for the Ecology Hour tonight comes from our members and Dunlap Roofing in Fort Bragg and Ukiah, where client care and professional service are standard, providing roofing services for discerning property owners throughout the greater Ukiah Valley and the Mendocino Coast. Done once, done right, Dunlap Roofing. At dunlaproofing.com, license 806-498. Indeed it is. Science is poetry in motion, so saith Thomas Dolby. Good evening and welcome to the Ecology Hour Science Edition. My name is Tim Bray. I'm in the Mendocino studio tonight with Dr. Robert Spies. We have an exciting project tonight. Bob, who have we got with us?
Well, we're very fortunate, Tim. We have Julia Parrish. Julia is the Executive Director of the COAST program, which is the Coastal Observation Seabird Survey Team. Julia is also the Lowell A. and Frankie L. Wakefield Endowed Professor in the School of Aquatic and Fisheries Science at the University of Washington. She's also an Associate Dean. And beside this citizen science program, which we're going to be starting off talking about this evening, Julia has a very large laboratory doing cutting-edge marine ecology research in three main areas: animal aggregations, that is, why do animals live in groups and how do they structure themselves in three dimensions, and social interactions, predator-prey, fish schools, and that sort of thing. Second area of their interest is seabird ecology, and Julia's and her students and associates have been doing a lot of work on one of the most common seabirds up and down the Pacific Coast, the common murre, looking at colony demographics and predator-prey interactions, and also coastal observations of seabird colonies and what they tell us about the condition of nearshore marine systems. The third area of interest is in marine conservation, trying to apply this information to management of seabirds and practical things such as redesigning trawls to minimize the bycatch of seabirds. So welcome to the program, Julia.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks, Tim. Really glad to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you. I know you were just down here in Mendocino.
I was.
How'd you like it?
You know, I'm so ready to move there. It is just, you know, I never know why you call it the Lost Coast. It should be the Found Coast because it's just so beautiful.
Well, this part of it is found. Yeah, there is a Lost Coast. And it's hard to find, actually.
Yeah. Come on. Come on down. We'd love to have you. Julia, maybe we could start off talking a little bit about this citizen science program, COAST. You're the executive director, and you were great in kind of extending the program from the Northwest, where it started, down into Mendocino County. Tell us a little bit about what the program's about and the kind of things that are accomplished and what you're learning.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be glad to. So COAST, or the Coastal Observation and Seabird Survey Team, started almost 17 years ago along the outer coast of Washington with about 12 people and some folks in my lab at the University of Washington. And we had an idea that you could tell a lot about what was going on with seabird populations and more broadly with the coastal marine environment by sampling what washed in on the tide. And turns out that's not a novel idea. There are beached bird programs pretty much worldwide, and there are some very old, really great programs in California. Gulf of the Farallones National Marine Sanctuary runs one, the Beach Watch program, which snugs up right to your area. They stop at Manchester. And then there's another great, great program, Beachcombers, in Monterey Bay. So I borrowed some techniques from them and got myself going with some volunteers out on the outer coast of Washington. And it's, well, you know, for me, it's kind of amazing. You can tell so much about what's going on just by looking at who washes in when and really thinking about that in two ways. One is, should this bird be here in this amount at this time of year, yes or no? And if the answer is yes, then things are great. And if the answer is no, it's at the wrong place, the wrong time, or it's actually missing, then that's a signal that that something is different, that something is going on. So really, when you think about it, all we're doing is creating a definitive baseline. We're figuring out what's normal, what should be washing in on the tide, and then as soon as we have that normal baseline, we can tell if there's any departure from it.
So that kind of actually ties into something, Bob, that you were telling me about maybe a year or more ago about your work in Alaska with the after the Exxon Valdez. There wasn't any such baseline.
Yeah, it was really interesting because this whole thing of interpreting seabird on the beach and so forth became a really important focus of those post-spill studies. And if you have one bird on the beach, I say a common murre, what does that really represent in terms of the mortality? And I think Julia and her group with Dee Boersma at the time were heavily involved in that. Isn't that right?
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, Bob, what you say is just exactly right. One of the things that, one of the many, many tragedies of Exxon Valdez was that we didn't know what the baseline was. And very, very same story for the Deepwater Horizon spill in the Gulf of Mexico. So we, if you don't know what's normal, that really hampers your understanding. If we see a lot of MERS washing in after oil spills, which we do in Alaska, in the Pacific Northwest, and down through California, there's a coastal oil spill, you know that MERS are going to be an affected species. And then the question becomes, well, you know, are they a major species otherwise in a normal, non-spill kind of environment? And it turns out along our coast, from Washington all the way down through California, around about August, September, October, MERS are actually the main species that we're going to see washing in. And that's because exhausted parents and inept chicks are just, you know, the coastal environment is lousy with those individuals. And so we're going to see a big spike of those birds. But after that, we're not going to see MERS, and we're not going to see them again until after the next breeding season. So when we have a winter spill or a spring spill coming in and we see lots of MERS washing in, we know that those are birds that are washing in at the wrong time, that there's something they do. There's something in their ecology, in their natural history, that's really putting them in harm's way when there's oil in the environment.
That's really interesting because this what I understand from talking to seabird ecologists like yourself is that they're, this big winter storms are factors. So I guess you don't find that affecting MERS as much.
Yeah, you know, and that's a really interesting thing. So you've just hit on the second major peak that we see in the normal baseline. The first one is post-breeding mortality, and I just talked about that. But the second one is winter kill. It's when those storms really start to roll in on into November and December, January. And those kinds of conditions make it hard for anybody to go out. You really don't want to be out in a small boat in those kinds of conditions. But it's hard to be a seabird, too. And so we see a lot of birds die through exposure and starvation. But it turns out not the ones that went through the post-breeding mortality peak. So those snowbirds that are coming down from Alaska, things like northern fulmars, will definitely see a lot of mortality of those birds in the winter. In fact, northern fulmars make up the majority of the birds we see on the beach in California in December and January.
Interesting.
That is interesting because they're generally pretty far offshore, aren't they?
They are. They are. And so a question for us is, do they, you know, maybe they tend to come a little closer into shore during those storm events. Some years, very stormy years, we'll see quite a number of those birds. But the other thing to think about is those guys have just finished breeding. They might be in the Gulf of Alaska, but they might be on up in the Bering Sea. And so not only have they depleted their reserves, so they've gotten skinnier through breeding, but they've just flown a very, very long distance. So it's sort of adding insult to injury, and they're at a real low point in their energy reserves. And so it's not uncommon to see birds that go through very extended migrations die at the end of those migrations.
Mm-hmm.
So another bird to think about is sooty shearwaters and short-tailed shearwaters. So they're going to come from New Zealand, from Chile, and they're going to fly all the way on up to California, and actually they're going to fly all the way on up past California up to Alaska. And we definitely see those birds as well. They die when they have gotten to the place that they're going in their migration.
So they get there, but there's not enough food to replenish the reserves they expended getting to the place they're going.
Right, absolutely. If you're doing the the 25-mile, the 26-mile marathon, and you get done and there's no food in the refrigerator, well, that's a sad day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. You touched on something really interesting, and I know of talking to some seabird biologists like John Pyatt that this interesting phenomenon of paying the price of reproducing, and studying some of the gull colonies in Alaska, they found that the birds that didn't breed actually had a bit higher survival rate than those that did.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But there's the classic trade-off, right? If you save yourself but you don't reproduce, well, you won't have a legacy, will you?
Right.
You know, that just there's a line I remember reading from an ecologist somewhere along the way. I've got to track this back down and find out who to attribute it to. But he was talking about how evolution works, and he said, you know, the system really works very well as long as you're not concerned with the individual.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what you're talking about. The individual, if he had the choice, would say, no, I'm not going to almost kill myself breeding.
Right. Absolutely.
You pretty much have to.
I think a lot of people, one thing a lot of people don't realize is how long seabirds live. So an albatross and a fulmar related to an albatross, they're going to live decades, 60, maybe 70 years.
Fulmars do too. They're that long lived. Ah, okay.
Yep.
I knew some albatrosses were. I didn't know fulmars were.
Yeah. So most of the tube noses, the albatrosses, uh-huh, fulmars, petrels, storm petrels, they're pretty long lived birds. And so an individual really does have to make some tough choices about what they're going to do, about whether their body condition is good enough to go through breeding, where they know they're literally going to be up late at night, not get much rest. You know, they're gonna be those classic new parents with the gray circles under their eyes, holding their kid.
That's, and the screaming chicks.
exactly. That's what seabirds go through, and so you got to be in great condition to get through that breeding season. Otherwise, skipping is better, right? You're gonna up your chances of living longer and having more kids in the future.
Do fulmars, as albatrosses do, breed irregularly or infrequently?
That's a great question. No, fulmars do appear to breed regularly. The albatrosses, you know, we're learning more and more about albatrosses from all of this cool tagging that's going on in the Northwest Hawaiian Islands. And it turns out that there are definitely birds that skip, so they're on again, off again, on again, off again. But the very, very best breeders are there almost every year, so they're irregular skippers.
So this is kind of gets to the thing of super fit individuals within the population.
Yep. Exactly right. And you know, so here is some fabulous data. Ann Edwards, who did this great postdoc, and she looked at stable isotopes. So isotopes of carbon and isotopes of nitrogen, and they tell us something about what trophic level a bird is feeding at and what kinds of food chains the prey came from, benthic ones or pelagic ones. And what she discovered was the signal from breeders that consistently failed on the colony was very, very similar to the signal that comes from feathers of albatross that have been taken behind longliners. And the birds that were super successful on the colony had very, very different signatures, indicating to us that those birds that are feeding behind the longliners that are going for bait may, in fact, just not be as fit as the other birds. Starting to paint this picture to us of how individual animals within a population might make choices and then what the consequences of those choices would be.
So they're the ones that are following the boats are basically going for the easy meal because they're not particularly good at foraging?
That's certainly one interpretation. And it's hard to figure out which is first, horse or cart, right?
Right.
So we want to be a little cautious about that interpretation, but just that understanding that even within a single, say, laysan or black-footed albatross population, you've got birds that are doing very, very different things, going to different places in the marine environment, interacting with very different prey, and thus their interactions with people might be very different. So when we're thinking about conservation strategies, we have to really be aware of that.
So this, just coming back to this COAST program for a minute, how is it actually set up? You've got volunteers that go out on the beach and count every so often?
We do. So I like to say you need to know three things to join our program. You have to be able to know the alphabet because our field guide is alphanumeric, and you need to be able to tell it's a bird. And in a kind of Monty Python way, you need to know it's dead. and if you can do those things, we can teach you in about 5 hours to become highly, highly accurate at identification. And that's because our program is not based on guessing. It's based on evidence.
Right.
So our participants are out there on the beach collecting evidence, things like standardized measurements of the bill or the foot or the wing. And what type of foot it is. It turns out, here's a geeked out thing. It turns out that you can tell a lot about what bird you have just by looking at its feet, because feet are really different from one kind of bird to the next.
So if you see a skeleton with a ball of feathers and some feet,
Tell you what it is.
Yeah.
So once you're trained as a COAST participant, you also pledge to go out and collect data monthly. And you do it in a standardized and rigorous fashion. So you go to the same place every month, you start your survey at the same point in the beach and you go to the same turnaround point so that every time you're surveying, it's that same kilometer of beach. And that allows us to build up that long-term or baseline pattern. Mm-hmm. So that's great because the individuals that are out there get to see what's going on. They get to monitor the changes, really get to understand their beach a little more deeply than they already know it. But then collectively, all of that data, we have about 470 sites that are monitored. We get a lot of information. We can tell when migration is happening. We can tell when winter storm events are coming in. We can see the response to crisis events like harmful algal blooms. We can see a fishery signal. We can also even see changes or responses to climate events. So there are a lot of things that we can tell by looking at that pattern, that space-time pattern of birds on the beach.
Interesting. So you must have close to 500 volunteers, is that right?
We have right now almost 900.
No kidding. Wow.
Yeah. Amazing. Who knew so many people would want to go out and look at dead birds?
And well, not only just look at them. I mean, it's one thing to poke at them with a stick, but you're asking for a little more than that.
I'm asking for so much more than that.
I think I need to go through the training, even if I don't do the monitoring, just so that I can understand what I'm poking.
Well, you know, a lot of people find it pretty fun. We have a lot of people who come to a training and they're a little bit sheepish or shy because they feel like they're not birders. They don't have a lot of bird expertise. Uh-huh. And so they feel like they want to participate. They want to be part of a rigorous science program. But they're thinking, well, you know, I don't have the expertise. And COAST is not about expertise. It's about precision.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that understanding the difference between those things is really important because anybody can be precise if you have simple rules to follow. And if you don't get stuck in science jargon land, so you can't understand the language. And I like to tell people that when we designed our field guide, which, by the way, has over 60 species and over 150 photographs in color of dead birds, you know, how many books can say that?
Is this, is this made the New York Times bestseller list yet?
It's on its way.
Okay.
You know, when we designed that book, we really had non-experts, non-scientists in mind. And in our first round of putting it together, the team at that time in my lab, we all sent the book to our grandmothers. And none of whom are scientists or were scientists. And we said, I said to my grandmother, Grandma, I want you to take this highlighter that I'm sending you, and I want you to just underline every single word or phrase which doesn't make sense to you. And so that's what we did. Our book is grandmother approved.
I love it.
All right.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Ecology Hour on KZYX, and we're speaking tonight with Dr. Julia Parrish, and she's the director of the Coastal Observation and Seabird Survey Team, and that's specifically what we're talking about right at the moment, survey that uses a protocol counting and identifying dead seabirds washed up on beaches. You just did a workshop here on the coast. It's kind of too bad we did this backward. We should have had this interview before that. And,
by now, I would have been flooded. Well, you know, I'll be back. That's one of the things about COAST. We don't just come to communities once.
Good.
We come back.
I know you got at least some people. I ran into a friend of mine who signed up to do a beach, so you expanded your reach a little bit. How, if someone is listening and wants to find out more about this and maybe join somebody who is already doing a survey, is that possible? And if so, how would they do it?
Yeah, absolutely. So the best thing they can do is they can email us at info@coast with two S's, COAST.org. That'll get to our volunteer coordinator, Erica Frost, and we can work with people and set them up. Or you can go to our website, www.coast, again with two S's, .org, and there you have contact information for all the staff, all the people who work in Coast, including me.
So is it only dead birds that you count on the beach? I mean, do you look at other kinds of phenomena?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Yeah.
Well, for now, almost 17 years, we've been doing dead birds, and I've been saying the whole time, you know, we got to expand into other data because there's so many other things. And we have a grant from the National Science Foundation, and one of the things that we're doing as part of that grant is expanding to look at marine debris. It's a very, very different thing. Of course, there's not a lot of natural history of marine debris. It's kind of, I guess you could say, it's unnatural history. But we're using that same approach that I described just briefly in terms of evidence. So in order to identify a bird, you're collecting several pieces of information. And not only are you, the coast participant, using it, plus our field guide to reach a conclusion, but our verifiers back in the lab are also doing that. So we can independently verify that you're right or you're wrong. And so for marine debris, what we're doing is collecting also, you can think of them as characteristics of the object that's in front of you. And one of those characteristics is the identity. But there's so many other characteristics that turn out to be much more useful when you're thinking about conservation and resource management. So let me give you an example. If you're an albatross, you're going to be looking for prey over the ocean that's going to be in the color spectrum, white through about dark red. And that's because you're looking for two main things. You're looking for squid, and you're looking for flying fish eggs, those crunchy little bright orange things that you have on top of sushi. Those are flying fish eggs. And they clump together, and so they make these sort of goopy, crunchy bits that are about 5 centimeters long, which is just about the same as the mantle, the top part of the squid that these albatross are looking for. So they're looking for very specific shapes, and they're looking for a very specific color spectrum. So if they come across a Bic lighter that's been tossed overboard, that happens to be yellow or orange or red, they're going to eat it. They're going to mistake it for prey. If they come across a lighter that's blue or black or green, they're not going to eat it because they would never mistake it for prey. So they don't care whether it's a Bic lighter. They care that it's a certain size and color range. So when you start to think that way about debris, it makes you realize that identity, well, certainly it's important because it gives us information about where things came from, but there's so many other aspects or characteristics of the debris that are important in terms of thinking about harm to wildlife. And so that's the coast approach to marine debris. It's a really exciting program. We're just piloting it, and we hope to expand that program down to the Mendocino area maybe 8 months or so from now.
Doesn't Ocean Conservancy, I know they have in the past done some marine trash and
they
so
do
forth.
Fabulous work. Yeah. They are focused more on identity of things than they are on characteristics of things. But they have just an incredible program, beach cleanup program, a sort of one day get everybody out there so that we can really get a handle on what's there. Yeah, it's a great program.
I know they've been trying to deal with the data, which is not simple.
Right,
in terms
exactly.
Of what is it and how much does it weigh and how many of them are there?
Right. And
counting fishing nets and cigarette butts in the same database.
Yes. Yeah, I can tell you quite a lot of interesting things wash up on the beach.
Yes, I could imagine.
Sooner or later, almost everything.
Yeah,
pretty much. And, of course, a lot of folks have been really wondering about and also worried about the Fukushima meltdown and the Japanese tsunami and whether the material from that tsunami, which is washing up on Pacific beaches and will continue to for years, you know, whether there's a radiation problem there. Of course, remember that tsunami happened many days before the reactor meltdown, so all of that debris, all that material was well into the ocean by the time the meltdown happened. But nevertheless, we are getting a lot of material from Japan on beaches, including California beaches. And that, of course, is making everybody think, if you happen to see Asian writing on a piece of debris, that it came from Japan. And what's so interesting is that we're finding quite a lot of material from mainland China, from Taiwan, also from Japan, from Korea. So there's quite a lot of material out there from a whole range of sources.
There's a lot of Asian vessels out fishing in the Pacific too.
Absolutely, you got it. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So a lot of material coming from vessels, a lot of material just coming over on that huge, big conveyor belt current, which sweeps up past Japan and then just heads right across the North Pacific and then bifurcates and comes down the coast, right past California.
Right, right. Well, Tim, do you think we're in a position to, if Julia would be willing to take some phone calls from listeners who may have questions about the COAST program, then we can continue on kind of between calls and after talking some more about seabird biology?
We certainly can, if you and Dr. Parrish are amenable.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I'll let people know how they can contact us. We are in the Mendocino studio, so the phone number here, the call-in line is 937-5103. If you'd rather email a question to me and have me ask it on the air, you can send an email to dj@kzyx.org. And again, we're speaking with Dr. Julia Parrish from the University of Washington about the Coastal Observation and Seabird Survey Team and what that is and what they're finding out about it, which it sounds like you're finding a great deal of information for a program that isn't all that old. When did you start this?
Well, we started, I think our first real year of data collection was 1999. We were a small program at that time. We didn't actually expand into California until 2006. So we have a slightly smaller data set for California. But, you know, we're in our 10th year in California, so that's pretty respectable.
And so you touched on some of the findings earlier, I think, about the kind of phenomena you can see. Maybe you could describe those in a little bit more detail, some of the main findings from this COAST program.
Yeah, so one of the things that we've done mainly on the outer coast beaches of California, Oregon, and Washington, and again, in California, we work very, very closely with our partners, Beachwatch and Beachcombers. And so we've established that normal or baseline signal with the two peaks that we talked about, one in the fall, the post-breeding mortality peak, and one in the winter, the winter kill peak. Turns out there's a third peak that happens in the spring. It's smaller. We think of it as an echo boom, and it's sort of a ghost signal of those birds that are just getting ready to migrate back up, mainly to British Columbia and Alaska. So that peak contains fulmars, but it also contains birds like rhinoceros auklets. So certainly they breed in our area, the West Coast, but their centers of population are north. So we have those three peaks, and we know who normally occurs in those peaks. And then, you know, over the years, we've seen quite a lot of changes, both more birds than normal, but also really interesting fewer birds than normal. So during 2005, for instance, we saw murres and cormorants and Cassin's auklets and rhinoceros auklets coming to shore in the spring, very unusual time of year for some of them, certainly for the local breeders, for murres and for cormorants. Not in very large numbers, but, you know, it gave us pause. And then during the breeding season, we had a total absence, during and after the breeding season, we had a total absence of birds on the beach. Why? Why didn't they wash up after the breeding season? Well, it turned out it was a terrible year in 2005, the beginning of seasonal upwelling, which really fuels the coastal ecosystem in Northern California, Oregon, and Washington, didn't start until almost July. And so those birds in the spring were literally starving to death. You know, they couldn't pack in the last calories that they needed to really set themselves up for breeding. In fact, they were dying in the spring, not enough food. And so they skipped breeding altogether in 2005. Lots of colonies just didn't have any birds on them at all. And so the reason that we didn't see that post-breeding peak is there wasn't any breeding. So that's a really good example of when to be worried about something because we're seeing a bird at the wrong time of year, MERS in the spring, and when to be worried because we're seeing a total absence of a normal peak, no post-breeding mortality. So we can actually tell from that pattern and the changes of the pattern on the beach, that actually tells us what's going on in the colony, how successful the birds are, and certainly whether they're breeding or not.
And you could put that kind of in the context of what other programs are looking at oceanographically and in terms of winds and climate and so forth.
Yeah. You are so right. You know, I really think of science as a team sport these days, especially. The ability of scientists who are doing very, very different kinds of things, atmospheric scientists and oceanographers and marine ecologists, to be working together all on different parts of a story. We just need to rely on each other to put that whole story together. So I can talk about El Nino just like the next scientist can, but to really understand what's going on with not only the weather phenomena, but the climate phenomena, the longer-term patterns of weather, I need to turn to other experts. And fortunately, you know, we all talk to each other, so that's great.
So, you brought up the subject of El Nino. According to the NOAA website, it looks like there's I forget the percentage, but it's a 70 or 80% chance of a big, strong El Nino this year.
And we just had just an amazing phenomenon of super warm water in the North Pacific.
Is that the blob?
That is the blob, yes.
Why don't you explain that a little bit to people? Maybe not everybody who's listening has heard a scientific explanation of the blob.
Well, I'll tell you a seabird biologist's explanation of it. So what developed actually starting in, let me think about this, summer of 2013, so more than 18 months ago, quite a long time ago, we started to see a pool of warmer than usual water, a few degrees warmer, but a few degrees in the ocean is a big thing.
Yeah, it's a big deal, yeah.
Yeah, and what was amazing was the size. So the North Pacific is a really large place, and so we're looking at a pool of warm water that's larger than the state of California. It's larger than the entire West Coast. And it got warmer and it got larger as we progressed into the fall and winter of the 2013-2014. And by the summer of 2014, that pool of warm water had split in half, and half of it went rocketing up through the Aleutian Islands and into the Bering Sea. And the other half of it slammed into the West Coast from British Columbia all the way down through Baja. But it took a while to get to the coast. And, you know, right along the coast, unless it's an El Nino year, we have pretty intensive upwelling in the summer and into the very early fall. And so that kept a pretty narrow strip of cold water all along the coast. So here's this huge big blob threatening the West Coast, but being held at bay by a very, very narrow strip of cold upwelled water. And by the fall of 2014, that blob had just subsumed that cold water and pushed it back down as all of that warm water came in. So why do we care about that? You know, so the water is 2 or even 3 degrees warmer than normal. Maybe it makes it better to swim. Well, it turns out that even 2 or 3 degrees temperature change over a long period of time is enough to change the whole base of the food chain. Changes which phytoplankton are out there, and it changes which zooplankton, so the little insects of the sea that are chowing down on the phytoplankton, it changes their populations. So we had a real change that went on there, and that made it harder for some fish to find food and harder for a whole bunch of seabirds to find food. So we actually had a huge, huge die-off of a little scrappy bird called Cassin's auklets.
Yep. Right.
And Coast, our program in Coast, we documented, and this is not with any extra effort. This is just people going out doing their surveys normally. We documented almost 8,000 carcasses of that one bird at a time of year when we might, in a normal year, we might see 100.
Yeah, it was spectacular. I saw that on our beaches here, and I wasn't even doing surveys. You couldn't avoid them. If you went to the beach, there were Cassin's auklets just fetched up everywhere.
And for every one of those carcasses, there may have been, I don't know, 10 or 15, 20.
Or 100 more floating around. Yeah.
Right, absolutely. So certainly tip of the iceberg in terms of how many died in that event. But super interesting to think about, well, why did so many of them die? We had Cassin's numbers that were over 100 times normal in some places. So certainly the diversity, distribution, and abundance of their food shifted. But the other thing to think about is they got compressed in that narrow strip of cold water. So they were much, much closer to shore, we think, than they would be normally.
Oh, now that's an interesting thing, because another thing I noticed last winter, because I'm a birder, and we do, mm-hmm. you know, the Christmas bird counts, and, mm-hmm. and we saw a lot, I at least saw a lot more ancient merlets in close to shore than I've ever seen before.
Yep, we saw a lot of ancients.
No kidding. Okay, so the blob was just pushing all of the species that ordinarily would be spread a little further out. They had to all cram into this little narrow strip of cold water near
that
shore.
That is our current hypothesis.
Interesting.
Yeah, so it's change in the food, but it's also this habitat compression.
Well, Bob and I had a conversation on this program a few months ago about the phenomenon you're just describing, where a temperature shift makes a change in the bottom of the food chain, from mm-hmm. dinoflagellates on one hand to copa. What was the other end of it?
Well, yeah, you can get this phenomenon where diatoms switch over to smaller...
To dinoflagellates.
Yeah. Right, that's right, exactly. Yeah.
And you get...
And that, on one that makes the food chain a lot less efficient.
Right, it lengthens the chain. If I remember correctly, you know, it was a three-step jump to get from diatoms to fish, whereas it takes five steps to get there if you have to go through the...
Dinoflagellates,
Right, right.
So, and each step of the way, you're only getting, what, 10% energy transfer, so...
Right, there you go. We also had a shift in the species distribution of copepods. So, the one of the dominant zooplankton groups along the West Coast. And a shift towards species that were smaller and less energy rich. So you can kind of think of it as the steak copepods went away and the Twinkie copepods came in.
So those poor Cassin's auklets forced to try to survive on a diet of junk.
Of junk. Yes, that's exactly right. So we are really wondering, it's kind of a 1-2 punch, right? Here the blob event comes in, creates a lot of change in the food, creates a lot of change in habitat, and then on top of that, an El Nino. So what's an El Nino do? It's going to very much weaken coastal upwelling strength, and it's going to push warm water from the south up our way. So we are already seeing some stress on the colony populations already.
I see a little thing in the news the other day where the galathead crabs, which normally occur off the coast of Mexico, are coming up into Southern California beaches in huge numbers. And I remember where our shipboard back in the late 80s, I think it was 87 or 88, there was a big El Nino, and the galathead, we'd sit there and watch the galathead crabs off Point Conception to go floating by the ship, and every 2 minutes there'd be one. It was amazing.
Yeah. Exactly. 82, 83
It was 82, 83.
Yeah, I remember I was in Monterey then, and it was impressive.
Well, if you just joined us again, I'll remind everyone that this is the Ecology Hour on KZYX, and we're speaking with Dr. Julia Parrish of the University of Washington primarily about the Coastal Observation and Seabird Survey Team work that she is directing, and also and some of the findings that are coming out of that and the uses to which those data are being put. And also, I'll just mention that if you're interested in finding out more about this topic or possibly joining a volunteer who is surveying beaches, I've put up a link to the COAST program on our Ecology Hour website. That's ecologyhour.wordpress.com. And you can find a link there to get more information. And also, I hope to have information by the end of the show about how they can order this book with the photographs of dead birds in it. I just cannot wait to have one of those on my coffee table.
Yeah, well, you know, we don't just have one for the West Coast. We have a whole nother one for Alaska and a whole nother one for the North Atlantic. So, I aim to take over the world of dead bird field guide publishing.
You're going to have the 5-foot shelf of dead bird
publishing. Well, you know, there's a lot of coastline out there in the world.
That's true.
Yeah, yeah. South Africa next.
So what is the title of the book, for a start?
Beached Birds.
Beached Birds.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, good.
All right.
Well, I'll have to get you to give us a link for how the how
listeners
can order that.
Look for it in your local bookstore, right?
Well, yeah, we're not we don't do a lot of bookstore sales, but certainly you can go to the website, the Coast website, and you can order a book there. We tend to prefer coming into communities and doing trainings and having people take our materials away when they sign up, including a copy of the book. And you know, the other thing that I should mention. When you sign up to be a COAST participant, you also get our ever-popular, non-denominational holiday card, which will probably be the only holiday card you will ever receive
with a dead bird
on the cover of it.
I don't know. I don't think you quite grasp how weird some of my friends are.
Dead bird Christmas ornaments, perhaps?
Yeah, I think that's possible.
Oh yeah, okay. You know, it could be a new outlet for Coast, but yeah.
Right. Well, we had pet rocks at one stage.
Yeah.
You know, that is true.
Cultural development. Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about? I found it interesting on your website a little bit about the bycatch work that you're doing and trying to reduce the. Actually, these seabirds get caught in trolls. So many people may not know that, but
they do. Yeah. So certainly, we know a lot about birds getting caught in hook and line gear, both commercial gear like long line gear or troll gear, but also seabirds get caught a lot in recreational gear. It's just that we don't have observers on the back of your Boston Whaler if you happen to pull up a mirror, but. A lot of birds also get caught in nets, in big trawl nets, and that's because they're hanging around the boat because fish are being processed on the boat, and they'll get caught up in the wings of trawls, and sometimes in the mouth of a trawl. And of course, we also know that birds will get caught in gill nets, both ones that are drifting at the surface, drift nets, but also set nets, so gill nets that are floating up from the bottom. In fact, that's one of the reasons that we know that common murres dive as deep as they do. They can dive more than the length of a football field. And we know that because they've been caught in set nets, so nets that were set on the bottom that were several hundred meters deep.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's just amazing. So our work on bycatch, and this is work that I did a little bit of. It's mostly done by a guy named Ed Melvin, who is with Washington Sea Grant. And he's an amazing, amazing guy. And he really has a thought that the way to go when you think about bycatch reduction is to work out in the active fisheries with the fishers. And that's because they're out there every day, and they really know what's going on. They're very, very keen observers. They wouldn't be good fishermen if they weren't good observers. And so rather than take a confrontational approach, and certainly an approach that might suggest that a scientist, an egg-headed scientist from a university, would actually know more than somebody who's out on the water all the time, Ed has really spearheaded a movement to work with the fishermen and sit down and try and puzzle through, okay, how might we change either the gear or the operation of fishing, the use of the gear, to try and reduce seabird bycatch. And we've been successful at all sorts of different gear change approaches. I was a little bit involved with some gill net changes, just really, really interesting changes. It turns out that when a bird of the surface, like a murre, comes up to a cork line, so the float line of a gill net, it doesn't just fly over or hop over the cork line as you think it might. In fact, what it does is it dives under, and when it does, it gets caught in the net.
Oh.
And that's because the net is invisible, because it's monofilament line. It's supposed to be invisible, right? The fish are not supposed to see it. They're supposed to run into it. And that's how we do salmon fishing. And so it turns out that by just putting a visible mesh panel in the upper about third of the net, the birds would come up to the cork line, they'd see the cork line, they'd dive under, they'd see that bright white nylon mesh, and they'd pop back to the surface. So it was very, very good at reducing bycatch just by changing the behavior. So what do the fish do when they see that visible mesh panel? They dive deeper, and they get caught in the net. So that was a gear change that dramatically reduced the bycatch of seabirds without any change in the catch of the target species, in that case, king and coho salmon. It's just a great story. And, you know, the great thing about that was we were working out with the fishers. And the first year we tested a whole bunch of different gear changes. And by the second year, we had boats lining up to work with us, because the guys that we were doing the work with, of course, are talking to everybody else, right? There's a lot of talk back and forth on the dock. And people are saying, hey, this is working. This can be a good thing. And, you know, that's really what I want to see in terms of conservation. I want it to be an interactive approach between scientists and the fishing community. I think that we can get so much more done when we're working together.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, make use of all the information.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, I spend a lot of time on the beach, and I spent a lot of time in the water, but just nothing compared to a fisherman who's out there. So being able to rely on their observations can make my science much richer.
Yeah, and there's all kinds of possibilities, too, of putting scientific instruments on fishing boats, too. That's being done more and more on a worldwide basis, and collecting some really valuable information.
Absolutely.
Well, we have just about 7 minutes left in the program before we switch back over to Philo for the ensemble program that comes up after this. So we've got time in here maybe for, if there's a listener who has a question, can call us up at 937-5103. Otherwise, we will wrap up maybe with some... Bob, you had some more things you wanted to pursue here.
I've got a personal interest in kind of this three-dimensional structure of these animal groups, and things like fish schools, and even, you know, we see what really grabs our attention here is we see these murmurations of
starlings.
Yeah.
And I go, wow, look at that. How does that happen?
Yeah, that's enough to make you pull your car over.
Exactly. I was taking pictures of my iPhone and go, wow, look at that.
Yeah.
It's kinetic sculpture in the air. You
know, absolutely.
Yeah.
But it happens underwater, too.
Yeah. So your lab does some of that kind of work, I understand.
Yeah. We don't do so much anymore, but yes. And that's how I got into biology, actually. I was just so fascinated by schooling in fish, but also it's a really aesthetic thing. Anybody who's been snorkeling or diving and had a chance to see a really large school of anchovies or herring or sardine or smelt, it's phenomenal. It's amazing.
It's an amazing emotional experience. It's great.
It, Oh, it is. It's beautiful. So it's aesthetic, and it's also, you know, I can remember one of the first times I was in a school of herring under attack by barracuda. I was on the East Coast, and so there the barracuda are large. And, you know, I got scared and jumped out of the water. In fact, I was like one of those little penguins. I could come all the way out of the water into the boat.
Flying out, yeah.
Yeah, and I was working with a guy from the Smithsonian, and I went back to the lab, and I'm all shaky, and I said, "Oh my goodness, I just saw this, and you know, there's blood everywhere, and the fish are being attacked." And he said, "Get back out there and take pictures. Nobody gets to see that." And so I thought, well, okay. And, you know, I'm still around, so that's good. But it's amazing to see how quickly those animals can respond and do it in 3D. I mean, think about this. Think about being on the L.A. freeway at rush hour, right? That's a two-dimensional situation. It's a lot of cars, and they're going really fast, and they're close to each other. And the only reason we don't have more pileups is everybody knows the traffic rules. So you don't actually have to know all of the other drivers because you know what they're going to do, and then you can use cues like vision to anticipate what's happening right around you. And fish and birds are doing the same thing, but they're doing it in 3D. So imagine that we flew planes at an airport that way. It wouldn't go so good. So somehow herring and starlings can do things that people can't.
Yeah. Their brains are evolved to do that somehow.
Yeah.
And it's a fascinating area of science, isn't it? The behavior and you just kind of alluded to the rules. You know, you mentioned traffic rules, and as
right.
I understand it, there's kind of something similar involved. There's some very simple rule sets that kind of govern the individual reactions that collectively make up these murmuration kind of movements.
Complex patterns come out of those simple rules.
Complex patterns from very simple rules.
Yeah.
Emergent
well, you kind of want simple rules. If you've got something, you know, if you're a starling and there's a peregrine falcon that's barreling into the group, you want to go for simple.
Right.
I kind of side with the peregrine in that.
Yeah.
It's funny you mention that because I actually just saw a peregrine today at my place, and I normally don't see them at my place at this time of year. I see them in the fall when the starlings come in,
mm-hmm.
and when I see a big flock of starlings, I start looking around for the peregrine and then watching them cut the flock into smaller and smaller chunks.
Yeah, that's amazing, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's basically their reaction to that whole schooling process is to just simplify, you know.
Yeah.
The problem is the complexity, and they're all about simplification.
Yeah.
So what kind of research have you done with that phenomenon?
Well, we were very interested in and still are interested in understanding, trying to figure out the traffic rules, understanding how individuals are doing that decision making, and whether those rules, you know, when you think about traffic rules, they actually change a little bit from country to country. For one thing, the Brits drive on the wrong side of the road, right? So if you don't know that rule, you could be in a whole heck of a lot of trouble if you're driving in New Zealand or in Great Britain. And so a big question in animal aggregations is, are the rules all the same? Right? Is there one base set of rules that everybody's using, or are they different? Do they change from species to species, or maybe they change from one situation to another? Maybe there are cultural differences. So the anchovies in the south at near Baja are going to have a different set of rules than the ones that are off of Oregon or Washington. And so, you know, maybe they're dependent on what kinds of predators are attacking. So we set up a whole set of experiments to try and get at that by actually using some pretty cool video equipment that allowed us to follow all the individuals in a group as they moved in three dimensions. And then create a computer rendering of that so we could ask all kinds of questions about who's next to who and who's going east and who's going west and really trying to figure the rules out.
Well, that's going to have to be a topic for the next time we have you on the radio.
Right.
We've got 30 seconds to get over to the Philo studio. Dr. Parrish, thank you so much for coming on the air. It's been wonderful talking with you.
Thank you, Julia. It's a great great interview. You're a wonderful guest. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Tim. Thanks, Bob. I really enjoyed it.
For more information, check our website, ecologyhour.wordpress.com. And